the Federation must work better. And right at the heart of the problems in the Federation is the fact that the states do not raise enough of the revenue that they spend. In other words, they're not accountable enough in the way a government should be. This is often described as vertical fiscal imbalance, which is a dreadful bit of jargon, but it basically means the states do not raise enough money.
Welcome to your Generic Live Show. This is the Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Generic Live Show for a Wednesday. So glad you could be with us here on the Generic Live Show. I'm glad people got a kick out of my last segment, by the way. The words there spoken by the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, talking about states and how there is an imbalance of how... Excuse me, I'm having a Coke, by the way, and I do apologise if I suddenly become gassy for some unknown reason. But states are... It's a vertical imbalance. States aren't getting the same amount of money depending on what they are. Malcolm Turnbull continues, and we'll continue that video here in a second, some income tax changes. He said, quote, we, the federal government, will reduce our income tax by an agreed percentage and will allow governments to levy an income tax equal to the amount that we withdrawn from. There'll be no increase to income tax from the taxpayer's point of view. According to the ABC, eventually states and territories will be able to continue to choose the amount of tax that they raise independently. Now, you may have heard this kind of... You may have heard negative gearing, capital gains tax, and GST. Mind you, the GST has been officially scrapped, apparently, from 10% of nationwide. We are moving to a more of a United States model, and I said this last hour, we are moving to more of a United States kind of territory, but you know, it's rough to say that it's exactly the same, because we have a nationalized tax, we have a nationalized sales tax of 10%, but states independently, think of the IRS, for example, have their own federal income tax. 43 states, though, only levy income tax. If you are lucky enough to be in the 7 states, this article doesn't actually outline what those states are. You will pay less if you're not in those 7 states. Now, we were talking about last hour on trying to provide the other side of the argument of why states should change their taxes. And this is going to play an ad, isn't it? It's not going to play anything.
For the best part of a century...
Oh, excuse me. Here's a video. I have not heard this, but it's from Peter Martin, the economics editor at The Age. He does a 2-minute-and-5 video here. You know what? We're gonna play that. We're gonna play that right here.
We've been living a fantasy. At federal elections, we've been able to vote for the party that offers low tax. At state elections, we've been able to vote for the party that offers good spending on schools, hospitals, roads. Malcolm Turnbull wants to break that fantasy. First, he'll offer the states more or less the health funding system they have at the moment. Hospitals will be more or less fully funded until 2020. Then from 2020, he wants to revert to the Joe Hockey model. That's funding increases in spending on hospitals only in line with inflation and with population growth. That's way below what hospital costs are actually doing. At the same time, he'll withdraw from the income tax space, so he'll cut federal income tax by a few percentage points. Then he'll invite the states to fill the difference. Now, they don't have to, but if they want to properly fund their hospitals, that's what they'll have to do. And to start with, they'll only be able to fill that gap. Beyond that, he'll take the limit off, and the states will be able to charge what they want, limited only by their electorates. He wants to force the states to face reality, that they can have good hospitals and schools, or low tax, but not both. And more importantly, he wants us to face reality as well. He wants us to take responsibility for the decisions we take when we're in the ballot box voting for state governments. If we want good hospitals, he says we should also be prepared to pay for them. If we don't, if we want to go to a low tax state, or if we want our state to become low tax, we can do that and accept lesser spending on hospitals. He wants us to make a conscious choice, something we haven't been doing for about 75 years.
So that's... Oh, I'm on. Yay! So that's a pretty well... That's a pretty well breakdown of what Malcolm Turnbull is proposing. Now, further in the article, it goes on to say, that is a good point. We can't have both sides of the coin. We can't vote in ballot boxes for better schools and hospitals in the state level, and we can't have lower taxes and budget deficits. So it's in the other. You definitely cannot have one without the other. In saying that, it's kind of not really. It's like saying, let's take it down a level. We had local council elections across the state in all of the local precincts. We had council elections where we voted for a new council. Now, the point of the council is to fix the roads and fix the footpath. Now, and while on the lower, on the higher level, we want more of those. I actually don't agree with this article. Only because we want, it's micro and macroeconomic issues, and this point of view is negating micro and macro economics on local level, on state local level. We want microeconomics. We want the issues that matter to us locally and independently. And in terms of macroeconomics, in terms of the whole nation, we want our economy to run better. We want deficits to be low. We want better trade, for example. The political aspect of macroeconomics and a world economy. So I don't necessarily agree on that aspect of this article. Makes a good point, though, in terms of states can raise the tax if they want to. Now, it's... Again, I said this last hour, I'm going to say it again. In terms of raising the income tax to raise money for local council projects, people are going to want to do that. Now, critics say, according to this article, that people aren't asked to put their money where their mouths are, which is fair. For the first time, Australians will be forced to choose between more health spending and lower tax when they vote. Well, this is true. The surveys are right. What are the surveys? Ah, okay, here we go. Mr. Munn refers to, of course, a 2001... Okay, 2001, a survey being done about tax and wealth were level pegging at 16.3 to 16.1, voting on what is more important to you. 23% labelled tax as extremely important in 1998, with 10% being Medicare. In 2001, tax and health were 16.3 and 16.1 respectively. In 2013, 19% say health and Medicare are extremely important, but 11% are concerned about tax. I have a reason for that. Reason for that is tax looks after itself for the most part. For the most part, tax doesn't change much in a country like this. I will say this. And Malcolm Turnbull says himself that tax hasn't changed for 40 years. We played the full video last hour, and we'll continue to play the video now. States might, according to this article, states might provide themselves as lower tax states, but that's not what we're, that's not the attitude we're in at the moment, though. I don't think that's the mindset that we're in at the moment. I really don't think so. I don't think that is the mindset that we're in at the moment. So, I understand what the article is saying. I don't really agree with it. Let's play the rest of this video that outlines what exactly are the changes.
And so they, as we know, every year and often several times a year, they go cup in hand in Canberra to Canberra and complain that the federal government is not giving them enough money. Now, we've got to recognise that that is the core problem. Many people have suggested we should address it. There hasn't been a serious effort to do so for many years, for over 40 years. What we are proposing to the states is that we should work together on this basis, that we, the federal government, will reduce our income tax by an agreed percentage and allow state governments to levy an income tax equal to that amount that we have withdrawn from. So there would be no increase in income tax. From a taxpayer's point of view, he or she would pay the same amount of income tax. But the states would be raising the money themselves. We would obviously administer it and collect it for them. So again, there'd be no compliance costs. But what this will do is give the states access to their own, an additional source of revenue, so that they will have a tax base that includes personal income tax. This obviously would not apply to companies, but personal income tax can be dealt with on a state-by-state basis. At the same time, we would then, with agreement with the states, withdraw from a number of the grants programs we have, so that from the federal budget's point of view, it would be, the outcome would be a would net off, so that we would not be, we would be making fewer grants to the states, but we would be receiving less income tax ourselves. The states would be receiving the income tax to cover those responsibilities. Now, this, we believe, is the only way that we can genuinely reform our federation. It will give the states real financial autonomy.
So that, that is what Malcolm Turnbull is proposing, a solution per se into in what Malcolm Turnbull is going there. Let's get to what states are saying. What are states saying? Now, what is the state I live in saying? Let's start there. Only because we're running out of time, but let's start there. The government, the premier, Anastasia Plibersek. So the government, federal government's good news, state government bad news. Mrs. Plibersek's opinion on the federal government's idea to allow states and territories to levy income taxes is not overly positive, with the Queensland Premier reducing the argument to optics and how the public would perceive the change. Despite being asked the question repeatedly for over a year, Ms. Plevisek has yet to state whether she believes that the states would be given the power to levy income taxes, even as she heads to the Council of Australian Governments meeting to discuss this on Friday. Her predecessor, Campbell Newman, or as I like to call him, Newman Campbell, had a firm view on the Federation debate, believing that the states should be given a slice of income taxes set to their own health and education budgets without relying consistently on changing of funding agreements and national punishments with the Commonwealth. On Wednesday, while standing up with the Health Minister Cameron Dick to discuss that what should change in the Ford funding agreement, would mean Queensland Health $11.8 billion in cuts, equivalent to $2.15 million less emergency department administrations. Ms. Plevisek seemed to have shown no detail of the federal plan. Quote, while I've had a lengthy conversation with the Prime Minister this morning to talk about the tax plan, and in fact he's given some details here, Ms. Plevisek said while hunting for a blank piece of paper she had brought as a prop. This is Malcolm Turnbull's tax plan, a blank page, because this is what we expect to discuss at the COAG briefing on Friday, where the states are provided with absolutely nothing, no detail, nothing. Now we expect more from the Prime Minister. I would expect more from the Prime Minister. In fact, I was given more detail from the former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, than I was from this Prime Minister. Okay, I shouldn't say this, but could you say government one more time, Prime Minister? Let's not play dirty politics, Dale. You're better than that. But in saying that, it's Queensland wouldn't fit this bill. We're much like Western Australia. We are a rural state for the most part. Most of our local economies drive off farming and agriculture. I couldn't see a tax that would squash that as relatively good. But anyway, that's enough on the tax. So we continue here on GLS with Dale Campbell. Thanks so much for joining us. Lots to get through to the last little bit. By the way, we've got the first Sydney siege giving new evidence. We've got the Great Barrier Reef might lose its listing. The FBI successfully and officially breaking into the San Bernardino attacked phone. An update on the US politics. It's all happening, and you're listening to it. We greatly appreciate you listening. Thanks for joining us here on a Wednesday. So much to get through. It's 11:22.
Finally found the most generic live show. This is the Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell.
Thanks for joining us here on a Wednesday, here on the Generic Live Show. Yes. We're running down to the weekend, right here on your Party Central. Ooh, yes. Now, what doesn't say a good party? Like having something to eat, you know? Actually, I had nothing to do with that. I'm just enjoying this song, though. I will say this. Ooh, yes. I'm just tempted to have that play out for the next couple of minutes, but no, up and moving here on a Wednesday. Thanks for joining us. Whether you're listening to us live or on your hard drive, we do appreciate you listening to us. I don't know why I played an upbeat song. Who is playing? Who's making me choose this music? But I will say this, changing gears slightly. The first Sydney siege hostage will give evidence. The Lind Cafe hostage, Jared Morton Hoffman, has given evidence and recalled the horrific ordeal as an inquest to the siege resumes. Mr. Morton Hoffman was employed at the cafe when the government Manharan Norris held 18 people hostage at Martin Place in December of 2014. The inquest heard Mr. Morton Hoffman intently thought the Reserve Bank across from the cafe was being robbed before telling the inquest. He remembered seeing his manager, Tory Johnson, appearing frightened while speaking with Norris. Mr. Hoffman realized that the danger was in the cafe when Norris produced a shotgun and put on a bandana wearing with Islamic writing on it. Moments later, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Norton Hoffman were ordered to lock the cafe's doors. The inquest heard at times Mr. Norton Hoffman tried to calm Norris, even helped other hostages escape. Mr. Norton Hoffman recalled noticing Zhang Bai, April, known for short, and Ellie Chan attempting to escape as they crawled underneath the bench, tried to unlock bolts from the doors around 5 o'clock that afternoon. The 000 calls from Mr. Norton Hoffman were made by the demand of Norris, also played to the inquest. Remaining calm and repeating Norris's instruction, he listened on. Mr. Morton Hoffman tried to give additional information to the operator. He was 19 years old at the time and he was working part-time at the cafe. Yeah, it's rough. We actually might want to track this down for next week, but there has been a series of updates in terms of the siege. We just couldn't fit them into today's episode. We got a lot going on. As we continue here on the Generic Live Show for a Friday, the Great Barrier Reef is a spectacle. If you come to Queensland, Australia, you've got to do one thing. You've got to come to the Great Barrier Reef, but it is in some serious trouble. We'll tell you more as we continue here on the Generic Live Show for a Wednesday. Glad you could be with us. There's a little update into the Sydney siege. We'll bring some more updates to you as they develop as we continue here on the Generic Live Show. Thanks for joining us. It's 11:30. We'll be right back.
This is the Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell.
Thanks for joining us here on a Wednesday with Dale Campbell. Thanks so much for joining us. Glad you could be with us. Whether you're listening to us live or on your hard drive, so glad you could be with us. Because we know you've got lots of options. If you choose us. Yay, go us. Thanks for joining us though. It's glad to be with us. Now, we are broadcasting live from Australia, the beautiful Queensland. We're right on one of the world's most beauties. But it's getting a little bit of trouble.
Scientists and
I'm gonna play the story.
Conservationists are warning that the latest mass bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef could threaten its World Heritage status. Last year, the United Nations World Heritage Committee decided not to put the reef on its in danger list, but it did put it on a watch list, which requires Australian governments to report back regularly on the health of the World Heritage Area.
Yeah, it's rough. The Great Barrier Reef, it's... lots of bleaching going on. Blames are going on the El Nino weather cycle that has been sweeping us for the last couple of years. It hasn't been going for the last year, but it's been triggered the mass coral bleaching that could threaten its World Heritage status. Scientists and conservationists warned, and conservatives, I guess. Conservatives are terrified about it. Footage released last week revealed brightly bleached white reefs along Queensland's far north coast. Janice Lowe, a scientist with the Australian Institute of Marine Science and member of National Coral Bleaching Task Force, said the current situation was looking really bad for the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. Quote, water temperatures have been really well above normal for the last several weeks now. And as we see the vision, large parts of the reef have been affected, Dr. Lowe said. But they only found evidence for four reefs without coral bleaching in the far north. Oh, no. Like that little clip said, it's on the endangered list, but it's not on... it hasn't had its... hasn't had his heritage listing removed. It'll be watching the UNECO, which is the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. It's watching this disaster with great alarm. But Richard Lee from the World Wildlife Fund, which provides advice to the Heritage Committee, says now the northern part of the reef has been severely breached, it's at the risk of coral mortality. I am certain that the UNESCO and the committee will be watching this disaster unfolding with great alarm, Mr. Leek said. Quote, I think differently in the early days on how they would respond, but the first question is, I'm sure that they will have, how does this affect World Heritage values of the reef? There you go. Dr. Lowe was saddened by it to think that it could become a reality. Quote, the northern part of the reef is what we call the most prestige part, less affected by human impact, she said. Though other major events like cyclones have struck the far north region, and that has not helped, and there is more on the way in the coming years, according to reports. The next conservation report is due in mid-2020. Not great. Environment Minister Greg Hunt said the environment would provide an update on the implementation of its Reef 2050 plan to the World Heritage Centre mid-next year. Quote, the extent of bleaching in the far northern third of the reef is of concern. We are continuing to monitor the situation closely through a combination of community and industry partnerships, rigorous science and advanced technology, a spokesperson for Mr. Hunt said. Not great. I like the Great Barrier Reef. It's a wonder. It's a wonder to see. There's some really pretty sights. So if you do get to check it out, please do check it out. And even if it is kind of bleaching white, it's still the fact that coral exists is just, it's great. And there's plenty of other things about the reef that more than the coral that is spectacular. But you've got to think as well, this affects the wildlife of the reef. Where are they going to go to? Where's the wildlife that relies on the coral? Where are they going to go when all the coral bleaches out? Shifting gears entirely, the FBI has successfully unlocked the iPhone without Apple's help. This is in relation to the San Bernardino attacks, a high-profile public and legal dispute between the government, the US government, and Apple is officially over after the FBI managed to unlock the iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino terrorists without Apple's help. The Justice Department says it successfully retrieved the data from the phone and are asking the court to validate the order for Apple's assistance. Quote, our decision to consolidate the legalization was based solely on the fact that with the recent assistance of a third party, we are now able to unlock the iPhone that does not compromise any information on the phone, U.S. Attorney Aline M. Decker said in a statement, adding that the investigation will continue to ensure that all of the evidence related to this terrorist attack is collected. The government is not saying exactly what the data was on the phone. Department of Justice spokeswoman Malene Newman says the FBI is currently reviewing the information on the phone, consistent with the standard investigatory procedures. This means the FBI experts took about a week to test the third-party tool that allowed them to crack the iPhone's passcode. For weeks, the FBI said it only helped Apple could the investigators lift the iPhone security that stood in the way of guessing its passcode. But last week, the government says a third party showed the FBI a new method that didn't require Apple's help. Apple released a statement saying that the government should never try to force a company to cooperate. Quote, from the beginning, we objected to the FBI's demand that Apple should build a backdoor into the iPhone because we believed it was wrong and would set a dangerous precedent. As a result of the government's dismissal, neither of these occurred. This case should have never been brought. We continue to help law enforcement with their investigations and as we have done all along, and we will continue to increase the security of our products as the threats and attacks on our data become more frequent and more sophisticated. I don't know why I'm yawning. This is not going to go away. The end of the legal standoff also means that there is no legal precedent gets or the scope of government's power to compel an unwilling company to cooperate in an investigation, for instance, by writing special software in Apple's case. Quote, it remains a priority for the government to ensure that law enforcement can contain critical digital information to protect national security and public safety, either with the cooperation of relevant parties or through the court system when cooperation fails, DOJ Newman said. We continue to pursue all available options for this mission, including seeking the cooperation of manufacturers and relying upon the creativity of both public and private sectors. According to the NPR, as reported before, the government may have unlocked the password on the phone by tinkering with the hardware. Given that investigations have the physical phone, or by exploiting an obscure flaw in the iPhone's software, a discovery of the software vulnerability could be a major reason for the FBI to keep the secret tool and reuse it in other investigations involving older versions of the iPhones, like the C a 5C, which was the model used here. Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's... I still don't know where I land on this. Hey, it's one of my most torn topics of the year. Yes, iPhone doesn't want to design a kind of backdoor. Let's do this kind of thing. Let's do this thing kind of basic. You know, I don't know what I'm trying to say. Breaking into people's phones, we don't want that to become public. And then the FBI is going, well, we're going to do it anyway. So whether you like it or not, it's just a common courtesy call to let you know that we're doing it. But it's interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see how this all kind of, shakes out. Yeah, well, Apple versus the FBI. Could we see a precedent, though? Although it didn't really go to a court case, so I don't think so. I'm not up on my law, but definitely not my US law, so I don't know how precedents work in US law, so that's something I'm up on. Meanwhile, coming in next, I had a story here and I lost it. Oh no! I lost the story about... Oh no! I lost the story about... About Dick Smith. Oh no! Oh no! I just lost it. Oh no! No? Oh, well. Well, I'll try and find it again. It's a story in relation to Dick Smith versus Bronwyn Bishop. About who wins the seat. And by no surprise, here we go. Aha. Businessman Dick Smith to run. Okay, here we go. So a survey found the move follows. Okay. Businessman Dick Smith says he is tempted to run as an independent in Bronwyn Bishop's electorate of Mackinac, regardless of whether she wants to win the Liberal pre-selection for the Sydney Northern Beaches seat. The move follows an opinion poll published last weekend, that showed voters in Mackinac overwhelmingly want Mrs. Bishop to retire, and only a fraction would support her if she did run. And that Mr. Smith is very popular in his own right. In the past, Mr. Smith, 72, has said he would only run if Miss Bishop, 73, was the Liberal candidate. His goal was to pursue as a veteran MP with whom he was friends since childhood to make way for younger blood. Pastor Lincoln Bronwyn Bishop, out in metropolitan New South Wales, been in since 2007, and is down 2.6%. A survey conducted by Media Research found that 69% of respondents said that Miss Bishop should retire, while 21% said that they would vote for her. A majority polled, 54%, said that they would give Dick Smith their primary vote if elected. What I am saying now is incredibly popular, Mr. Smith said. I am very concerned with the three main parties are distorted with potential growth, which will destroy Australia. Construction of high density residential buildings was leading to a sense of crowding in the electorate, he said. With higher immigration rates, we are all leading to congestion. We still have backyards with kids playing cricket. That's all going to go, he said. It's interesting. Yeah. Liberal versus Dick Smith. I wonder who's going to win that argument. So we continue here on the Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell. We'll give you a quick update in the US politics. And yeah, we'll give you a quick update on US politics and where it all stands. Some of the races and some of the states, the victors may surprise you. We'll give you a full shakedown, a presidential shakedown, as we continue here on the Generic Live Show for a Wednesday. Thanks so much for joining us. It's glad you could be here. It's 11:51.
This is the Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell.
Thanks for joining us here on a Wednesday here on the Generic Live Show. Thanks so much for joining us. Glad you could be with us. It's a pleasure. We're winding down our broadcast here on a Wednesday. Thank you so much for joining us. It's good to be here, as per always. We haven't done this in a while, and I feel like it's a good reason. Let's do a U.S. presidential shakedown. We're doing a shakedown. So, let's go all the way back. Actually, let's not go all the way back. I have a feeling we talked about Super Tuesday, and that's about it. Let's go back, though. So, the presidential primaries in the US are happening. So, let's tell you who is left. The Republicans. We've got Trump winning all the delegates. By the way, on the Republican side, you need 1, 2, 3, 7 to win. There are still 943 delegates available. Trump has 736. Cruz has 463 for Cruz and 143 for John Kasich. Dropped out on the Republican side, who people have dropped out. Bush, Carson, Christie, Fiorina, Gilmore, Graham, Huckabee, Jindal, Pataki, Paul, Perry, Rubio, Santorum, and Walker. Who won where? In February, which is not showing, for some bizarre reason. Why is February not showing? That's weird. On Super Tuesday, though, yeah, that's weird. It's only showing March. So let's go after Super Tuesday. Cruz won Kansas. On March 5, we had Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, and Maine. Cruz won Kansas and Maine, while Donald Trump won Kentucky and Louisiana. March 8, we had Hawaii, Michigan, Idaho, and Mississippi. Trump won Hawaii, Michigan, and Mississippi. Cruz won Idaho. March 12th, we had Washington, D.C., where Rubio won. which that doesn't matter at the moment, and Wyoming, where Cruz won. March 15th, which was the follow-up to Super Tuesday, we had Illinois, North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, and Missouri. Trump won Illinois, North Carolina, Florida, and Missouri. John Kasich won Ohio. March 22nd, we had Arizona, where Trump won, and Utah, where Cruz won. And over on the Democratic side, remember, on the Democratic side, we have those super pledged delegates and super delegates, which play into more of the side. Hillary Clinton has 1,712. By the way, you need 2383 to win on the Democratic side, where 2,049 are still available. Dropped out on that side were Chafee, Lizig, O'Malley, and Webb. Pledged delegates for Clinton, to break that down, 1,243. For Sanders, is 975. The superdelegates, Hillary Clinton has 469 and 29 for Sanders. Let's go post-Super Tuesday. Kansas, Louisiana, and Nebraska. Sanders won Kansas and Nebraska. Clinton won Louisiana. On March 6th, we had Maine, which Sanders picked up. March 8th, we had Michigan and Mississippi. Sanders won Michigan and Clinton won Mississippi. March 15th, we had Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, and Ohio. Clinton swept. March 22nd, we had Arizona, Idaho, and Utah. Clinton won Arizona. Sanders won the rest. March 26th, we had Alaska, Washington State, and Hawaii. Sanders swept. So it's going to get interesting. I don't think Sanders is going to get there, unfortunately, but Sanders is picking up a pretty good race. That is your presidential sweep, and that, ladies and gentlemen, rounds up our broadcast for another week. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure as always. The pleasure is always mine. It's 12 o'clock.
This has been a Chef Wonder Media production. For more, visit chefwondermedia.net. Delivered fresh to your ear holes. Copyright 2016.
This has been a podcast of the Geek AO Media Network, where you put your geek in and geek out. For more geeky goodness, head over to geek-io.net. Copyright 2016.